Thank you for coming. As you know, this is a little bit of an introduction to what catechesis looks like at one parish, which happens to be St. James Cathedral. And it's offered to you as an example, a sample, of how a process of intentional disciple-making might look in one parish setting in the form of adult catechesis. Okay? Does everybody have a handout? What we have at St. James is once a year, there is a Easter Vigil service in which adults are baptized. So the adults are never baptized, almost never baptized, with the infants. The infants are baptized every couple of months. But if an adult wants to be baptized, they only do it once a year at Easter. Okay? So before I came to St. James, they would have a 5-week thing during Lent where one of the priests would meet with the people who wanted to be baptized for 5 weeks before Easter, and then they were baptized. So when I came along, they threw that in my lap, and I was like, 5 weeks? How am I going to teach everything everyone needs to know about being a Christian in 5 weeks? So I beefed it up to 12, so I started it in January, and then 50 people came out for it. So it was a bit of a because I wasn't prepared for that many people, and I had to do it, unfortunately, as a lecture, because there were that many people. No, they had discussion groups, but it was hard because, there wasn't anybody, I didn't have a team in place to lead discussion groups, so they were on their own, and then they had to come back and things like that. And so, the year after that, there were 25 people. The year after that, there were 15. And I could deal with that, okay? The year after that, I actually started to make it what you see here now. So by the third year I was doing it, we're looking at pretty much an entire year's worth of curriculum, okay? So I started them in September. Okay, so people that would come to be baptized at Easter started the course in September, went all the way through to Easter, and then continued on to Pentecost with an optional unit over the summer. Okay, so if they wanted, they could go for the whole year, right? But at least for 9 months, right? And in a small group, that was the model that worked for me, so I've been doing that for about 4 years now. So that's sort of how it got started and how it ended up looking like this, okay? So our lovely office manager makes these brochures, and she picked all the pictures, which is kind of cute. She's got baptism of Jesus, and he's looking a little cold there. And then, and she's got the icon of Jesus, the teacher, and then she's got Elijah and Elisha, which is kind of cute. But as you can see, it's something, well, we kind of like, we're on a budget, so I think it said something like 2012-13, and she just blanked it out, and she says, you can write in the next year for that, so we just use these, and we advertise them in the church. Come on in. No shame, no blame. Okay, this is for you. So we don't do a lot of advertising beyond having this out all year round in the sort of literature rack and kind of having stuff on the websites. That's about it. And so off of that and foot traffic, we get like about a dozen to 15 people every year usually. And that's really just the right size for discussion. It can be smaller, like the group this year is six people, which is really nice. That's a really nice size group for discussion. But every year they're different. Sometimes they're a whole bunch of introverts. Some years they're a whole bunch of extroverts. Some years they're real, like, kind of hardcore thinking types. Sometimes they're really, like, gut-churning feeling types. So it's all different every year. So what I've provided here is a kind of loose curriculum that I fiddle with every year based on, first of all, what people's learning need, what their level of learning is at. So do they have a lot of previous exposure to scripture? That's rare Usually people are cracking it open almost for the first time, okay? You know, how churched they are, as they say, things like that. Whether there's a lot of out-and-out seekers, which we also get, right? We sometimes get people that said, I've decided to be baptized. What do I have to do? And you hand them this, right? But some people are like, I don't even know if I believe in God. Can I take this course? Yeah. Okay, right? So you have this huge range of people, okay? And it's something that you have to constantly tweak. I have to constantly tweak even this to adapt to whoever's in the group that year, okay? So I'm just going to discuss the first part, if that's okay. Are we ready? Do we have any questions yet? Yes, sir. So the question was, going from 5 weeks to like 9 months for a baptismal preparation course, how did people respond to that kind of a level of commitment that was being asked of them, number one? And then number two, what happens if people come in the middle of the year? Okay, these are really good questions we've had to deal with. First of all, I find that most people are really willing to do that long. They don't have a problem with that. This is for people who are being baptized themselves, right? And so it isn't like for parents of kids. And so they are very, very willing to do that length of time. In fact, they find it exciting, right? And especially once they get into like the group bonds very quickly. And it's something they really look forward to every week, and they miss it when it's over, right? Because it's a really powerful fellowship experience as well, right? So I don't get people balking at that usually, okay? And if they balk at it, they balk at it. And I say, there's other places you can go if you want and get a one-on-one with a priest for a short period of time, but this is our process here. If you want to be baptized here, this is our process, right? And you wouldn't regret it if you did it, and most people go for it, right? Middle-of-the-year problems, middle-of-the-year woes, okay? I have to have a cutoff point, right? Because it's not fair to the people who have been coming since September. So I say, up until Christmas, I'll take you and try and get you caught up. But beyond that, you gotta wait until the fall. And what I do is I try to get people plugged in different ways so they can do some preparatory stuff. And most people are actually okay with waiting. Okay, some people are kind of like, but I have to get baptized now in case something happens, right? You know, and you work with that, right? Okay, but for the most part, people are okay with waiting because they have busy lives, right? And they're like, okay, I can wait till the fall to do this. And then for the people who have to get caught up, it can be a steep, because they feel like we had somebody come in January and they missed the first part, and they're just kind of like, because they've missed a lot of the background for the Gospels and things like that, and so they've had to do a lot of reading to catch up, right? But you help them, right? Right, so that's sort of how that works.
So what do you do for
Oh. Oh, okay, so the question was, this is adult catechesis, how do the adult catechumens feel about what is done for the parents of babies being baptized? First of all, they are blissfully 100% ignorant of what gets done for the parents of the babies, because that is all done by Father David Brinton, the sub-dean of the cathedral, and it is done in one afternoon at the same time as the rehearsal for the baptism. Now, if you ever wanted to see a 1.5-hour crash course in the absolute essentials of things you need to do as a Christian parent, you're never going to find a better example than that. 1.5 hours, okay? Okay? It's pretty awesome. It's breathtaking, actually, okay? But I am not involved or have an involvement in that. In that learning process. Does that help? Okay. Ian.
Well, I
So Ian's question was, why do people come for catechism? Okay, so they come for lots of different reasons. First of all, most people come because they feel they want to deepen their relationship with God, and they want to do that through baptism or confirmation, okay? And so this becomes a requirement for baptism or confirmation. So that's the first group of people. Second group of people are seekers, and they want to have a chance to explore the Christian faith in a environment that they can learn and not be pressured, right? So that's the second reason why people take the class. Third reason is people who, you know, for one reason or another feel that they want to consciously make a kind of solidification or recommitment in their faith. So they do what's called the reaffirmation of baptismal vows. There are people who are a lot later in life who want to do something like that, right? And they get a lot out of taking a class like this, even though they know a lot of it already. And what's so helpful for having people like that in a class as the same class as seekers, the same class as really young people, is that, I mean, the experience they share, right? And the life insight they share is pretty powerful, right? You have people who have held on to their faith through a lot of stuff, and they can witness to how it's made a difference in their life to people who are seeking. And that's pretty cool. Like, it's neat to have them all in one group, is what I mean. So those are kind of three reasons why people take the class. Handout? Do you want a handout? Okay. Yay, front row! Woohoo! Okay, so I'm gonna talk about part one, okay? So as you can see, the first thing we do is read all four Gospels and discuss. Okay, what I mean by that is that I get them to read one chapter a day, beginning with Matthew chapter 1. Okay, so they are reading seven chapters every week, and we meet once a week, okay? So they can make it through all four Gospels by the time you get to Christmas, okay? And for almost everyone that comes to the class, it's the first time they've ever read through, sequentially, the Gospels. Because even if you've been coming for a million trillion years in the Anglican Church, you'd be getting snippets from the lectionary, and it's not as if you've sat down and read it from cover to cover. And it absolutely, that act alone is worth the course, because it's so illuminating for people and actually kind of life-changing, you know, just to do that, you know. Just because people are different and they have different sort of ways that they take in information, I like to have a video component, okay? And it's like major cheese, but it's Philip Yancey's The Jesus I Never Knew, okay? Now it's light, L-I-T-E, okay? But, however, the cool thing about it is that he uses clips from pretty much every conceivable film that's ever been made about Jesus, right? And what he does is he unpacks these sorts of stereotypes that we have about Jesus, and he compares them to, if you're going to actually look at the gospel, what's the kind of figure that's being presented there, and what's he saying, right? And it's fun because it challenges people's preconceptions about who Jesus is, right? And people react quite powerfully to it. So you have like this kind of la la la, you know, Cecil B. DeMille Jesus, and then you have this like intense, who's the fellow that made the Pasolini, right? Angry Marxist Jesus, right? And it's kind of fun, like comparing all these different things, right? And so that sort of goes along pretty well with the study of the Gospels, because it goes in order through the Gospel narrative, the sort of paradigmatic Gospel narrative, right? So that's one thing we do. Another thing we do is we look at the Apostles' Creed, okay? And then I have this really fun video of these really nerdy British theologians. You know, like, first rate, you know, people like Alistair McGrath and Callistus Ware and, what's the fellow's name, N.T. Wright, and people like that. Okay, right. Okay, you know, the usual suspects, right? Okay, and they're first rate, but it's like hilarious because they're such a bunch of eggheads, right? And it's such a contrast from Philip Yancey, right? So that works for people who have like kind of a heavy duty intellectual interest in doctrine. Okay, and so there's some people that are kind of, they like the movie stuff, and then there's some people who go for the heavy-duty doctrine, right? And they can really sink their teeth into that, and it's when people find that helpful. So that's one thing we do. And then, because Advent rolls around towards the end of the first section, we start getting them to have a sense of what the structure of the liturgical year is. So what, obviously, when it begins, where it comes from, what the seasons are, right? What the feast days are and how everything builds up to Easter and things like that, and how it's grounded on the gospel narrative essentially about the life of Christ, right? So so we start to talk about that. So that's the first section, okay, up to Christmas. Do we have any questions? Yes. Okay. So the question is how is the class formatted? So how do you fit in all of this material in one class? It's the whole evening is pretty much 2 hours. Okay. So they are gathering. The class begins at 6, but they are gathering by about 1:45. Or 4:45, and so I just send them upstairs, and they kind of chill out with each other, and they bring snacks, and they eat, and they talk, and that's their time to kind of bond as a group, because I'm not there, right? And they're sitting there talking to each other, which is kind of cool, and getting to know each other, right? And then, so at 6, we start with 1 hour of discussion on the scripture reading, okay, uninterrupted. That's just the focus, okay? And then at 7, I put in the video, okay? The video is usually 20, 25 minutes. We have a brief amount of discussion after that, and they are out the door again by 7:45, okay? So in terms of actual class time, it's about a little over an hour and a half, but the total time commitment is about 2 hours. Does that help? Okay. Okay, so Ian's question was, in the discussion, does it flow easily, or how hard is that to manage? Okay, so my experience with Bible study, and from the giving and the receiving end, is that it can be like pulling teeth. Like, there's these questions, and nobody knows the answer, and everybody's just kind of going, And when I was a student, I used to actually get a headache off of the Bible studies we did, because they're so, like, inductive, right? But this is different, right? So I don't do a Bible study in the sense that I'm not asking them leading questions. I'm giving them assigned readings every week, and I ask them to bring two things to discussion every week. First of all, something that they were really moved by, they found powerful, okay? Second of all, whatever they don't understand, okay? And the result is that there's no problem with moving the discussion. Like, the problem is with getting them to stop, right, after an hour, right? Because they get to a level of comfort where they feel like they can ask anything. It's pretty powerful and it's neat, right? And as I say, because of the mix of the kinds of people there, like, I always get everybody to weigh in, right? And everyone's gonna have a different perspective and be coming from a different place, and it's really helpful, right? I always get them to answer their own questions, essentially, right? Because that's how they learn, right? It's not about me telling them the right answer, right? But I'm guiding them to the point where they can get to that place, right? And they get there on their own. Just okay, right? Yes, sir.
Maybe this is a 12th thing. No, so you say you're guiding them in this direction, like you did now. Do you ever have any time where you feel like they haven't got where you're called and given them?
Oh, I never let them. Okay, so the question is, you're guiding them to the right answer, but does it ever happen that they didn't get to the right place? No, because I kind of always make sure that they're not left hanging. But the fact of the matter is, if you're not prepared to make that profession of faith, you're not going to get baptized, right? No one would want to be baptized unless they can say yes to those things, right? So it's not as if anybody is interested in doing that without actually being there. But yeah, I mean, all to say, it's a style of teaching when you can get people to answer their own question, right? It's just a style of teaching that helps them because the answer will stick with them. You'd be amazed. I mean, like, everybody's brain is about as sieve-like as mine. And they can ask the same question over and over again. If you just tell them the answer, they will not remember, right? But if you get them to work their own way to that answer, they have a better chance of remembering what it was. Okay, so, I mean, it's just a helpful thing. Like, there was this discussion. They all came to evening prayer one day, and it was Father David who was officiating because I was setting up for the class, actually, that evening. And he read the reading, and one of the readings was about the, you know, rich people getting through the eye of a needle, blah, blah, the camel getting through the eye of the needle, right? And they all came to class in this big horror, about as white as sheets, going, there was this reading at evening prayer, and it said about the camel and the eye of the... Does Jesus want us to be poor? Right? And so, like, I am not going to answer that question. They're going to answer, like, what do you think? Okay? Well, and then we had this excellent conversation after that, and they got to the right place with that. They really did. And I was just like, ha-ha, they're awesome. Anyway, but do you know what I mean? Like, this, in that sense, the class actually kind of teaches itself. It really does. And that's when it's most effective, you know? Anyway. What do you think? Okay, are we okay to go to part two? Part two. Part two is where we are right now, actually. They're finishing up Acts on Tuesday, but they do Acts, okay, and then they do a bunch of the epistles and Revelation, okay? And the video we do, if they have an appetite for it, is Jesus, the New Way, which is serious N.T. Wright madness, okay? So it's all that kind of historical background for the Gospels. If you have the appetite for it, it's a ton of fun. If it's a really kind of touchy-feely group of students, you kind of forgo that jazz a bit. But it's helpful because it answers a lot of people's questions about some of the stuff that goes on. And then you get really deep into studying the liturgical year because Lent's coming up, right? And talk about the spirituality of Lent and how essentially this whole process of catechism comes out of a spirituality of Lent. Like, the season of Lent was originally a season of preparation for catechumens, right? And so talk to them about, you know, Lenten disciplines, why you would want to do something like that, and how it's a reflection of really what Christians do all the time in terms of spiritual disciplines in general, a rule of life, things like that. So there's a sense in which Lent is a kind of a little kind of snapshot picture of ratcheted up Christian spirituality, right? And talk to them about Holy Week, and because we have a very full celebration of Holy Week in the parish, and so, you know, when they go through that that whole journey of the week's liturgies, that's never anything that people, if they haven't done it before, are actually really prepared for, in the sense that they know what to expect. They get to Maundy Thursday and they just, their minds are blown, right? But the subdean likes to invite the catechumens to have their feet washed. So there they are in the middle of this chancel with this choir singing away De Rufle Ubi Caritas, and they're just like, oh my goodness, I think I'm going to pass out because the archbishop is washing my feet, and I finally get it, right? There's a moment when they get it. And then the stripping of the altar, and then the church is so dark after that. And they're just, their minds are blown, because one of the catechumens said, for the first time in my life, I could imagine a world without God. when they had removed the sacrament and stripped the altar, right? And so that's the kind of thing, like, they're impacted by it in a way that they perhaps weren't prepared for. So to talk to people about what the liturgy is and how it carries you through that story of that 1 week in real time is something that I like to focus on during this time. One of the other fun things we do is we watch this really, really old, very cheesy documentary about the history of the Anglican Church with Michael York, and he's like really young in it. It's hilarious, and he's like totally over the top in it. He's only the narrator, and he's over the top, okay? But it's fun because it gives people a sense of the historical roots of Anglicanism, right? And also how the good thing about it is how they focus in the last episode about how it has become a global communion, so it's not the Church of England, thank you, right? But it's become something that crosses cultures in a very powerful way, right? And the final thing that I do is I try to talk in a really, like, a deeper way about the nature of the sacraments and how they function in a Christian's life. To help you grow spiritually, right? So that sorts of things all get covered in this chunk of time, it's heavy, but by this time they their appetites are whetted and they're ready to go, right? Yeah. Does that make sense? Question? No? Okay. Okay. And then they are baptized. That's right. So the question was, that's when they're baptized. Yes, they are baptized between parts 2 and 3. The question is, do I rearrange the canonical order of the gospel so that Luke flows into Acts? No. There you go. David. I did?
Am I right? I think that at one time you offered a study of the Old Testament with...
We hadn't got there yet. Part 3, jumping ahead. Okay, you ready? Part 3? Okay, so everyone's been baptized, all right? Now they get to read the Old Testament. And everyone's like, why do we get to read the Old Testament from the beginning? Because you can't read the Old Testament if you're a Christian unless you've read the New Testament. Because Christians read the Old Testament through the lens of the New Testament. Okay? So they don't get to read Genesis until they've been through the whole New Testament. And then they read Genesis and they get it. Okay? So I used to have a lot of trouble with figuring out how to manage enough of the Old Testament through the rest of the year for it to do them some good, right? Because it's a lot of reading, right? Okay? So I tried having them each do a book and present it. I had, you know, giving them chunks of each one. I tried, okay. And then I lucked out because this thing came out called The Story. Have anyone seen The Story? Okay, right? Now, what I like about this thing is that it doesn't paraphrase. It's taking, it's published by Zondervan, and it's a condensation of the Bible that takes out the repetition in the Old Testament that's there because of the different sources like JDP, right? So it'll take that out, and so it doesn't repeat, and it gives you this kind of blow-by-blow narrative really quickly of everything and without leaving anything out, okay? So that people can get through the Genesis narrative, people can get through the Exodus narrative, people can get through even things like Leviticus, okay? So that they get the sense of what's in there without having to go verse by verse through a lot of repetition, which makes it longer to read, right? Now, right away they notice, this is weird, it's going too fast. You know, I mean, what about everything else? And I'm like, well, you could just go read it. It's right there in your Bible. Okay, and they do, right? Because it whets their appetite and, right? So, but this, that is what I use to get them through basically the Old Testament. Say again? It's called The Story. It's published by Zondervan, and it is a condensation of the NIV. Okay? And it has a lot of helpful supplementary materials, but it essentially condenses the entire biblical narrative into, I think, like 20-some chapters or something like that. So that works real well, because they get the story, as they say. Okay? And the other thing that I do during this time is I give instruction in different kinds of prayer. Okay, so they're all traditional forms of prayer, but it's just so that, because, you know, everybody will have been praying all this time for sure, but you want to help people to form a discipline and have a toolbox, in a sense, for forming a discipline for the rest of their lives, right? And my own experience is that I can't just do one thing all the time for the rest of my life, right? Like, there's times when I need to pray in this way, there's times when I need to pray in that way, and there's times when I have to add them all together, right? You know? So I try to give them about five or six different things that are kind of standard and that will pretty much everybody can connect to one or the other of them or several, okay? So what we have is Lectio Divina, okay? There's a scripture contemplation specifically, okay? So praying with scripture, the daily office, morning and evening prayer, the examine, which is this sort of Ignatian reflection on the events of the day to find God's presence in what happened to you during the day, the rosary, the so-called Ignatian contemplation, which is a way of praying with a gospel narrative that involves your imagination, very, very core to the formation of Jesuit priests. What I do is I introduce this to them one per week, and I make them do it during the week, and then they have to come back and report what it was like the week after. Okay? And what you have happening is people will latch on to one or the other, and it'll be like totally life transforming for them. So it's like, oh my goodness, I've been doing Lectio Divina all my life and I didn't even know. Okay. And then you'll have people that are like, the examine is the thing for them, that it's just like absolutely eye opening, like the scales falling off, because they can see, they can understand their day, they can challenge themselves to hear God more carefully during the day, things like that. Okay. Some people connect with the rosary. For some people, the Ignatian contemplation is a breakthrough for them, because it's the first time they've had a kind of an encounter with Christ in praying scriptures, but an actual encounter with Christ in which they were aware of coming face to face with Him, right, in that prayer, and that's hugely powerful, right, for people. And then daily office, everyone has a curiosity about how to make the books work, right? But also for people who operate well praying on a schedule, that's really powerful for them, right? When they pray when it's time to pray, right? That's a really powerful thing for them, right? So you have all these different things, and inevitably people are wired differently, but inevitably they'll respond to one or the other of them, right? Meantime, my video, more Philip Yancey, okay? And this one is shot in Colorado, which is where he lives, I guess. So it's hilarious, because he's always hiking in the mountains, like in the footage, right? So that's why I call him Wild Man Phil of the Mountains. And if you know what he looks like, it's funny. Wild Man Phil of the Mountains. Anyway, okay. So that's sort of the wrap-up bit. And that takes them up to pretty much Pentecost. And if you want to know what that was called in the ancient church, it's mystagogy. Okay. That's okay. Ah! Yes, Ian. So the question is, did anyone go through three parts and say that I can't make it? Usually they bail before Easter, okay? Yeah, but that has happened. Yep. Okay, so the optional bit is fun, okay? So you kind of take a poll about what people want to learn more about in the summer, and you do a book study with them. So it's the same format without the video, but you get them to read a book that will supplement their learning. So some years people have picked Surprise by Hope, which is N.T. Wright's book about resurrection. Okay? Some years people have picked, you know, a book on spiritual disciplines or something, you know, like Richard Foster. And some years people have picked, like this is the year that people got the most out of it. They picked a book called Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist. It's a recent book that came out. And that blew people's minds. They loved that because it helped them unpack the Old Testament narratives in light of, like, to help us understand who Jesus is, right? And to help us understand communion and things like that. So, I mean, like, they really like that one. So that carries them through the summer, usually. And that you can have a bit of fun with that, depending on what they want to read about, right?
Do you suggest any books? What do they bring
forward? No. I ask them what sort of things do you want to do, and then I kind of weigh it out and find something that'll work for them. Yeah. And the good thing is that some of them actually have a video, like the N.T. Wright one had a video, so that was helpful, you know, because he's a dense writer, and so it helps when he has the video, he's a very clear speaker, so he can kind of lay it out in brief, understandable form, right? Anyway, so that's pretty much it. Yes? Okay, so the question is, what does ongoing teaching look like? Okay. Now, the thing that I wish I could do is clone myself. Not really, I'm kidding. Maybe alien robot clones would work, right? But what I need to do is I need to build up a team of catechists, essentially, right? So ideally what you would want to be doing in a parish is keeping an eyeball out for people who are able to teach, okay? That way, you could accommodate more catechumens during the year, so you could have more than one evening where you had a catechism class running, okay? So that way, if I had 50 people, I could accommodate them all in this kind of a model, right? I wouldn't have to change to a lecture format or anything if you had a team of people that you had trained for that, right? The other thing is that then, if you had enough small group leaders, okay, you could have cell groups coming out of this, essentially, right? So Bible study groups. So I have a small Bible study group that is always busting at the seams, okay, because I can't clone myself, okay? So what we need to be doing is, and I hope to be able to do this, you know, but forming people to do this kind of work of teaching, right? And that way you can have a really strong follow-up. Right? As it is, we get people plugged into the study groups, small study groups, but we don't have a program in the way that I would really like us to have an ongoing sort of study groups, large numbers of them actually, for all the people that are interested in and have come through the formation system. But people plug in pretty well to the parish life after they've come through, and so they, you know, they get involved in various different ways. And then we always have these sort of like big monster parish educational events. I remember David doing the video at one of them one time when John Bowen came to talk about C.S. Lewis. But they have these big monster events that happen. They're like several weeks of lectures and the whole parish comes and pile into the parish hall and have supper and listen to a talk, things like that happen, right? But yeah, that's the kind of thing you would want to do if you had the resources and you had the people and work on building up is to have small group follow-up, you know? Or the kind of thing that Tim Houghton does where it's actually individual follow-up, where you work with people individually. And that would be the setting, really good setting for forming a team of catechists is if you had individual discipleship meeting with somebody over the course of time so that, you know, if you initially discerned that they had a charism for teaching, you know, to build on that and say, you know, think about doing this, right?
Is the position you have a position that is solely built for this purpose, or,
like,
what's your goal?
Okay, so the question is the position that I have solely built for this purpose? Yes and no. I was hired to do adult education, but because this parish is the way it is, there's a lot of stuff going on, and there's four services a day, and there's a lot of other stuff in between, much of which is silly, but which requires the use of a great deal of clergy hours, okay? So if this were all I was doing, I would be very happy, and every evening would be used up on doing this, and I would be happy because I would be able to build teams and have lots of small groups. But as it is, because I have a lot of other stuff I need to do, I can't, which is why I want to have alien robot clones. Here we go. Okay, so there's a question about if I were going to build requirements in terms of mission and service, where would that come in? So that comes in towards the end, because inevitably people want to start serving. Like, there's a natural desire to start doing that the moment they're initiated, right? So that we don't lack for that. So basically we just say, this is what happens in the church. Have a look and see where you want to plug yourself in, right? And sometimes we've had people come in and talk about those ministries, you know, just to talk briefly to them about what they do, and so they can put a face to a name in terms of that. But we have a lot of social outreach. We have, you know, a lot of, because it's such a big church, we have a lot of volunteer guilds that keep the place running in spiffy order. We have a lot of, you know, these kind of groups that reach out to the community, so they're a lot of the kind of social concerns, things like that. So you know, there isn't, everybody finds a place in a sense, like that where they plug in, I think. And obviously, some people look to serve outside the parish bounds, and that happens a lot. So you help them to discern that. Like, somebody ended up volunteering in a really intensive way with the diocese, because they figured out that their skills and background fitted something that was that they needed, right? So that's kind of cool, right? But that's a matter of people become aware that they need to contribute something, and that involves who they are, and you help them to see how who they are is something they can offer to the life of the church for the world, right? Mm-hmm. I've been just doing this for the few years.
So you've got a group of people that have been through this intense year, 9 months of training and discipleship, which is amazing. I think most of us, they give us 10 people that have been through this and will change the world. But, and then you've got all the other people in the church that were baptized from under the old set of rules. So what's that doing to the congregation? And you have people that had the quick and easy baptism.
Okay, so the question was, so I've been doing this for a few years, but then before that, people would have the quick and easy one, and how do they fit in the church community with the people that went through the intensive one? That's fun. They actually kind of resent it that they got the quick and easy one, and they want the big one, right? Now, a lot of them, that's one of the reasons why that first year I did the long one, there was 50 people. A lot of them went and signed up for that, even though they had already been through the short one. Okay, and you know, I mean, the people that come through end up in positions of leadership, right? So they it's really interesting. So they're very much aware of what goes on, and they know that if they want to learn more about ... they can always ask me. Yeah, and I don't, if people want to come and sit in, I don't say no, you know. How about right here?
Yeah, sort of a question. If there's space, if there are only so many catechumens, could it be in Christian education course for a number of baptized?
Yeah, so the question is, could there be a Christian education course for the already baptized? And the answer is, of course, yes. Oh, yes, it can. Absolutely. Yes, this can be a course for the already baptized. There's no reason why not. Has it been? No. But, I mean, people come that are already baptized because, say, they need to be confirmed, or they want to renew their baptismal vows, or what have you, right? So it's not as if everybody is, like, completely unwashed, Okay, great. I saw two other questions. Yes, ma'am. Yay! And you are welcome to. Yay! So the question was, have I ever considered doing something online that would, you know, I mean, enable people, more people to be involved in a learning process? And the answer is no. Not because, for no other reason than A, I lack the expertise, B, I lack the time, and C, that's a whole nother ball game, right? When you're doing online learning, it's a different kind of process, right? And this is very much a group process of learning, right? Yeah. So the question was, is there a way that I could adapt this to my parish context without having to reinvent the wheel? Is there a curriculum? And the answer is actually no, because. No, because every parish setting is different, and there's a sense in which this is already loose, okay? But it provides an overall structure that I think needs to be adapted to a specific context, right? And these are all things that are readily available on Amazon. So I would actually say you don't want to have a tight curriculum because there's a sense in which you know what it is that people need to learn. Like, and then what you need to be doing is adapting that framework to your context, right? This works for us because we are so liturgical. Right? And so the whole life of the church is driven by this immense tank of liturgy, right? It's really like riding a big tank like that, okay? And so to build it around the liturgy and have this massive climax at Easter, and then you ride off the energy of that in terms of your Christian formation, right? It works, right? And I think that in different contexts, a different structure would work really well as well. You know, like, I mean, there's a sense in which I drew a lot on RCIA for this as a model because they're the same, they only do once a year at Easter, right? But what they do, and this is how they accommodate people that come in February, is they do a rolling thing. So it never stops. There's no beginning and there's no end, right? It's very loose, right? But they ratchet up a certain, because you have to declare yourself as a candidate for election on the first day of Lent, first Sunday of Lent, right? So that's when they start to formalize. But you can go through the year, and it's so informal, right? And it just keeps rolling and rolling and rolling. And they have a team of catechists that rolls and rolls and rolls, right? Okay, so that's another way you could do it, right? If you had that kind of, like, a lot of people coming and going, you know, that sort of thing. So I would say you actually want to adapt it. You want to adapt it for wherever you are. You know, yeah. Okay, so the question is, what about youth as opposed to adults, right? Okay, so we don't have a lot of youth because of our location, right? So you have a lot of people who just got married, maybe just had a baby, right? But the moment their kids get to be, you know, like 4 or 5, they leave because it's condo land. Right, and you can't really raise a family of active kids in a shoebox, right? So we have very few young youth. Okay, so what we have done with that is we have a relationship with St. Clement's, who they get a lot of teenagers coming through confirmation because of the school. And so if you get, because it's so awkward, if you get like one teenager and you, they just want to like run away, okay? So they need community for learning in the same way that adults do, right? So we have to do that. Like we form a relationship with a parish that has a lot of youth and plug them in there, and then they can come back and if they want to be, but generally they elect to be confirmed with all the other kids, okay? But sometimes they come and they get confirmed in the parish because it, you know, it's their parish or whatever, their parents go there, you know? You bet. Oh, the question is, could you use this for youth? Yes. Yes. Yep. Yep. No more questions? Thank you.